I'm Al Filreis, and this is Poem Talk at the Writer's House, where I have the pleasure of convening three friends in the world of contemporary poetry and poetics to collaborate on a close but not too close reading of a poem. We'll talk, maybe even disagree a bit, and perhaps open up the verse to a few new possibilities, and we hope gain for a poem that interests us some new readers and listeners. And I say listeners because Poem Talk poems are available in recordings made by the poets themselves as part of our Penn Sound archive, writing.upenn.edu/pennsound. Today I'm joined here in Philadelphia at the Kelly Writer's House in our third floor garret studio by Randall Couch, a Poem Talk original, poet, editor, university administrator, teacher of writing and poetics at Arcadia University, editor and translator of the poems of Gabriela Mistral, published by Chicago in April 08, and by Michelle Taransky, whose poems have appeared in Denver Quarterly, How To, New American Writing, Drunken Boat, The Continental Review, and elsewhere, and whose first book, Barn Burned Then, was selected by Marjorie Welish for the 2008 Omnidawn Poetry Prize and will be published during fall 2009. With degrees from Chicago and the Iowa Writers Workshop, Michelle is now a member of the Writers House staff. And by Natalie Gerber, a member of the faculty of the State University of New York at Fredonia, who has staffed the Geraldine R. Dodge Poetry Festivals and coordinated the famous Lunch Poem series at Berkeley and assisted Robert Haas during his time as Poet Laureate, who loves nothing more than to talk about poetry's form, prosody, sound, and line. Welcome all three of you to Poem Talk. Natalie and Michelle, your first time on Poem Talk, thanks for coming. And thanks, Natalie, for coming down from New York State, New Jersey?
Both.
Both. Well, there's a trick. And for finding a little bit of your lost voice so you could join us. How is that voice of yours?
It's performing.
Great.
Thanks.
Thanks again for coming. Our poem today is by the great late poet Barbara Guest. It's from her 1973 book, Moscow Mansions, and it's called Roses. Our recording of the poem comes from a studio session called The Location of Things, which is also the title of Guest's first book of 1960, and the reading, which took place at the Artists Access Studio in New York in 1984, includes poems from that book and later works from the 60s and 70s. So here now is Barbara Guest reading Roses.
Roses. A painting has no air, Gertrude Stein. That there should never be air in a picture surprises me. It would seem to be only a picture of a certain kind, a portrait in paper or glued, somewhere a stickiness as opposed to a stick-to-itness of another genre. It might be quite new to do without that air, or to find oxygen on the landscape line, like a boat which is an object or a shoe which never floats and is stationary. Still, there are certain illnesses that require air, lots of it, and there are nervous people who cannot manufacture enough air and must seek for it when they don't have plants in pictures. There's the mysterious traveling that one does outside the cube, and this takes place in air. It is why one develops an attitude toward roses picked in the morning, air, even roses without sun shining on them. The roses of Juan Gris, from which we learn the selflessness of roses, existing perpetually without air, the lid being down, so to speak, withal a 1912 fragrance sifting to the left corner where we read La Merveille and escape.
Well, I think we have to start with the epigraph from Gertrude Stein, painting has no air. And I think all four of us separately and together found the source for that, which is news. But before we get to the source, can someone say, prior to having found the source, what you thought it meant? Painting has no air. And also, if you don't mind answering this too, how you think the first couple of lines of the poem made a rejoinder to that epigraph, to that sentiment. Michelle, do you want to start? What do you think it said?
Knowing Stein's relationship to the cubist and to cubism, to me, the insistence on air is about the perspective that the viewer chooses, whether the viewer is the painter or the person coming to their table in the morning.
Okay, so a painting has no air is said in the negative, though. Natalie, what's your first impression about why she's being negative, and why would a later poet, Barbara Guest, start with a negative?
I wasn't sure. I wondered about suffocation. I wondered about reproduction, knowing how important reproduction is to Barbara Guest. And quite frankly, I was confused, particularly because of the way that the first sentence begins with a notional subject, that there should be no heir, surprises me.
So it's a way of saying that Gertrude Stein could have felt this way or said this surprises me, do you think?
Yes, but I'm also want to talk about and wondering about the tone of it. Certain critics like Donald Revell has thought that Barbara Guest is rebuking Stein in some way here, and I'm wondering if she's testing out a stance toward a moment in 1912.
Okay, Well, Randall, I guess you're the guy, one of the guys, who can tell us where this comes from. Would you explain where the epigraph is from, please?
Sure. Stein, on at least two different occasions, told an anecdote of an experience she had when she was about 8 in France, standing on a platform at a station and was surrounded by a panoramic painting of the Battle of Waterloo. And from her book, Paris, France, she says, "It was then that I first realized the difference between a painting and out of doors. I realized that a painting is always a flat surface, and out of doors never is. And that out of doors is made up of air, and a painting has no air. The air is replaced by a flat surface, and anything in a painting that imitates air is illustration and not art."
That there should never be air in a picture surprises me. It would seem to be only a picture of a certain kind, a portrait in paper or glued, somewhere a stickiness as opposed to a stick-to-itness of another genre. It might be quite new to do without that air, or to find oxygen on the landscape line, like a boat, which is an object or a shoe which never floats and is stationary.
Natalie, let's go back then to the question of the opening, because I think I'm with Revell in thinking she's saying, no, Gertrude, that's not all there is in the first few lines. What do you think?
I think so. If I can do very briefly a little bit more of the provenance of this, the poem is about, has the epigraph from Stein, and the painting, which we'll discover that it's about by Juan Gris, is dated 1912.
And it's called?
Roses or Flowers, which is interesting. And if you look at MoMA or Christie's or Art Store, it's dated as 1914. And it's Stein insists that it's 1912. Stein owned the painting, which Williams knew when he wrote about it, and we'll get to that. But there's both a tradition of looking at a painting and looking at a painting that's been seminal to poetry and seminal to this moment of breaking away into the modern in 1912 when the Armory Show is being planned but hasn't occurred yet. So Gris's work is not widely known right before the Imagist Manifesto. I think she's doing what she does in another poem, The Farewell Stairway, of looking back at a moment just before the cusp of a modern experience, their futurism, here looking at the breaking into modern poetry.
That's terrific. So when she gets to the second stanza and she begins it with still, and I know I'm jumping ahead, but
yes,
when she says still could mean in the lawyerly sense, to be sure, yes, but now we will move in another direction. Not disputing the previous proposition, but adding to it, or indeed refuting it, still is also kind of a nice way of saying you're wrong, and we shall go on. First impressions, before we get into it, Randall, Natalie, which is it? Is it still, yes, but there's more, or still, no, you're wrong, and we're going to fix that?
Well, I would submit that if she's looking back at a moment in which there was a fork or a divergence in the sort of evolutionary tree of art history and history of poetry, that she's saying from the perspective of 1973, that there are other branches that we can build on besides that branch.
So in short, and I'm just, my job is to be reductive.
Sure.
In short, she's saying, well, Gertrude, yes, you know, modernist airlessness has its place. Yes, cool. But for some people, we need more than that. We need real air, or we need to breathe.
Still, there are certain illnesses that require air, lots of it. And there are nervous people who cannot manufacture enough air and must seek for it when they don't have plants in pictures. There's the mysterious traveling that one does outside the cube, and this takes place in air.
I wanted to turn to Michelle to help get the distinction, which is perhaps funny, between stickiness, which would be the Juan Gris, and something else that's a stick-to-itness, which is an alternative to the Gris-Stein-Williams lineage that we're talking about, I assume. How would you make that distinction?
For me, the stickiness versus the stick-to-itness refer to the newspaper being actually collaged onto the painting, but also for guests, it sticks this painting in a particular time. It's from 1912. The paper is French. This can't be guessed encountering this for the first time. She's encountering something that's already encountered. And for her, that experience is in the composition, in how she proceeds to make the poem.
So I want to stay with this. The stickiness, I'm being a little more literalistic, I think. Stickiness is a nice, deep, and funny way of referring to a collage sort of thing, because you stick things on it and so forth. Stick-to-itness, which is generally a positive, you know, nose-to-grinding-wheel focus, seems to be an alternative as opposed to a focus or concentration. So it's collage, modernist collage, Stein-Gries-style collage, as opposed to focus and concentration of another genre.
Right, so guest right there already opened, she contradicts Stein.
She's opening up
that there are more than one, there is more than one genre.
Yeah, I guess I'm trying to get Natalie to say, this is, just for the fun of it, Natalie, she's starting to think of a post-modernism or an anti-modernism.
But from what I've read of her, and I'm new to guest, she seems to say that there isn't a postmodern, or she doesn't like what postmodernism is, that she returns to the modern moment. As Michelle said, she's encountering something that's been encountered, but perhaps looking at it from that moment, how new and odd it might be to do without air. And I know in her later works that light and air and space are crucial to her. So I see an imagination returning to a moment of breakage, and I think that the final stanza in some way gives us an escape. But I'm not sure that for me, in the first stanza, the literalness, the stick-to-itness, is a positive or another genre. So I might be disagreeing.
Well, what about the tone of, it might be quite new? I mean, in my copy, I put new in quotes and made it a capital N as if it were make it new.
Right.
Mm-hmm. It might be quite new. Here, I'll tell you what I think the tone is. Yeah, it might be new. Sure, Gertrude, it's new to do without air. Airlessness is new. But still, there are certain illnesses that require air. Now, what's the tone? Michelle, where are we tonally? Is there any irony in there?
Well, with it might be... in that third sentence, she begins another string of logic. So we're presented with this idea of air that she turns, and then and this is another huge turn. It might be quite new to do without. And for her, I think it is new, and it is a newness. And you can see that in the repetition of air line to line. So I don't think the new is necessarily negative. I think it's, for her, the new is new to me.
Which is new?
Looking at this closely this time.
Looking at this
painting.
This painting and this turning point and Stein's reminiscence of her own turning point.
Guest has said in interviews she continually uses words like reverie and haunting and the mysterious thing, something behind a poem, something you leave off saying, and that still remains of that left-off thought. So it my sense is that there, if you think of the word air as being roughly equivalent to atmosphere, and you look at Guest in the context of someone like Ashbery, for example, it seems to me that there's an exploration here of other kinds of poetic value, and I loved Natalie's way of setting this up as testing an idea. It seems to me like an exploratory, fairly gentle and generous, but ultimately, I hate to use the word rejecting, but ultimately declining to follow in Stein's footsteps.
Yes, I agree with you about that. And the second stanza gives us a bunch of hints. I guess after talking about it for a minute, we should turn to the third, where this thing either synthesizes, you know, we have the Steinian position and then we have the alternative, and then the third stanza might be a synthesis. But we have a very, I think, moving pitch. There are people with illnesses who need air. There are nervous people who can't manufacture their own air and must seek it when they don't have plants, which, of course, make oxygen and air in pictures. And then there's mystery, which Randall was suggesting is important to guess, that one does outside the cube, which, of course, is the reference to cubism, outside the box, outside the cube, doing something different. And this takes place in air. Air is good. Air is real. Air is nature. We want air. Up with air. Down with airlessness. I'm exaggerating.
It is why one develops an attitude toward roses picked in the morning. Air. Even roses without sun shining on them. The roses of Juan Gris, from which we learn the selflessness of roses, existing perpetually without air. The lid being down, so to speak, withal a 1912 fragrance sifting to the left corner where we read La Merveille and escape.
So let's get back to roses. Williams, we've referred to Williams. The Rose is Obsolete, I think, is the one we're thinking about in particular,
yeah,
which is from Spring and All of 1923. And I'll direct this question at Michelle. The Rose is Obsolete. This is a programmatic poem, a polemic poem. Down with the old rose, let's come up with a new rose, a metal rose, a sharp rose. The rose carried weight of love, but love is at an end. This is a real tough, hard-nosed, no more roses, no more Valentine's Day poem. How does it, and it's got to be in there because Williams was referring to Juan Gris, I think, pretty directly here. So how does this fit in with maybe this last paragraph where we have an attitude toward roses picked in the morning air? I can almost breathe the air of that phrase.
I'd like to not refute, obviously, Guest as a member of the New York School, but maybe suggest that she does have a lot in common with the Objectivist, with Williams, with Zukofsky, with Creeley, that the air in here, it is the insistence to notice the particular atmosphere that you are in and to look at that rose. And in this poem by Guest, there's a lot of words that point to still there, that there. And so I think that that's her showing us how poetry can point to particular things. So I think she's actually taking up Williams's charge to find the particular rose of that moment that she wrote this poem, not his rose or Stein's rose or Gris's rose. What do you guys think?
Randall's about to say something.
Well, the Guest poem is full of ideas about the thing and not the thing itself. One develops an attitude. The roses are personified as being selfless. There's a phrase, so to speak. There's a fragrance that's sifting within the poem. Those to me seem like quite a contradiction to the Williams poem, which is in effect an attempt to be a cubist poem. It's all about concentrating meaning at and of edges. The rose carried the weight of love, but love is at an end of roses. So it's the end of the shape. So
and
he seems to be
self-referential.
Yes, and he seems to be enacting Stein's emphasis on the relation of the art object to the viewer rather than on the problematic of representation. And My sense in the last stanza of the guest poem is precisely when she talks about the lid being down and those poor roses selflessly sacrificing themselves without the air, and that we, in our relationship to this art object, read in the left corner the word "the marvel," and thereby escape from this suffocating environment. That the tone of that seems to me not a reinforcement of Williams, but rather perhaps a sort of dialogue or perhaps friendly dispute.
Does anyone here see a nostalgia in the final stanza? A way of both embracing with a certain wistfulness, but also ultimately rejecting these techniques and strategies?
I do, and I think I'm now finally persuaded by something you said earlier about the use of Stein. I would say this briefly, that the use of Stein refers, it's only four words from something we had to find, but there it is. It's just a mnemonic device for her to get started on the poem. It's not so much what young 8-year-old Gertrude Stein discovered in that experience of looking at a painting, is that it's that there was a turning point in her life looking at a painting. Forget about what she decided, which way she went in. This poem seems to be reminiscence, maybe even nostalgic, of a moment of that there could be such a moment when one looks at a painting and one's course changes.
I love what you're saying, because it seems to me, from what I've read of guests' interviews and such, that she talks about that experience for her as a poet, a young poet in New York, looking at the painters and finding a way forward and a new way to create.
Before we get to the Gathering Paradise segment of our show, let me ask each of you to offer a brief final word on this poem, or maybe something more on what you get from it. Randall?
I guess what I love about this poem the most is that it seems to be a poem that's so much about openness and possibility and the instability of objects. Like an Ashbery poem in which you always think that you're just about to nail down the logic of the poem and you never quite do. This poem suggests that there's always something more there than the rose, or the representation of the rose, or the poem about the representation of the rose.
Natalie?
A meditation on poetics, unlike other poems of hers, where she says, after Miro, for the poetess. And it's clearly an ekphrastic poem. Here, a poem about a painting, about a poem owned by a poet, looking at the rose, the most symbolic symbol slash object of all time. What is poetics to do with roses?
Yes.
Michelle, a final word.
While I read this poem, I was immediately reminded of one of my favorite guest poems, Invisible Architecture, where she says, there is an invisible architecture often supporting the surface of the poem. For me, this poem, Roses, is a perfect example of the poet performing the surface of the poem and being happy while doing it.
I do sense happiness. I'll add a final word. I've read many, I made a study of this actually, anti-modernist arguments that followed modernism, and many of them said things like, you know, modernism's advocacy of airlessness, of lifelessness, of art, of separate from life, and so forth, led us down a blind alley, and it's terrible. This poem seems to start with that counter-argument, but obviously, as we've said, develops into something much more generous toward the alternative possibilities, and in doing so is generous to subjects of certain illnesses, to subjects who are nervous, to subjects who want mystery. And those are people that Gertrude Stein didn't have a whole lot of time for, but Barbara Guest does. We'd like to end Poem Talk with a minute or two of Gathering Paradise, a chance for several of us to spread wide our narrow hands to gather a little something really poetically good to hail or commend someone or something going on in the poetry world. Who wants to gather some paradise? Natalie, you're smiling. You must be thinking of paradise.
Well, the Geraldine R. Dodge Poetry Festivals may have to cancel its 2010 festival, which is devastating, but they've made available videos of all of these poets at a channel on YouTube, the Geraldine R. Dodge channel, so it's wonderful to check out.
And in a phrase, why does Dodge have to close down? Will Dodge close down?
The economy.
The economy. Michelle?
I'm looking forward to the publication of an essay by a very good poet friend of the Writer's House and myself, Dorothea Lasky. Her paper, Poetry is Not a Project, is going to be published by Ugly Duckling Press. Very exciting.
Thank you. Well, that's all the stick-to-itness we have time for in Poem Talk today. Poem Talk at the Writer's House is a collaboration of the Center for Programs in Contemporary Writing and the Kelly Writer's House at the University of Pennsylvania and the Poetry Foundation, poetryfoundation.org. Thanks to my guests, Michelle Taransky, Randall Couch, and Natalie Gerber, and to Poem Talk's director and engineer, James Lemaire, and to our fabulous editor, Steve McLaughlin. And a shout-out to Ann Becker, Catherine Mattern, and others for producing that great studio recording of Barbara Guest in 1984. Next time on Poem Talk, three road-loving young American poets converge on Philly to talk with me about Alice Notley's constitutional or maybe unconstitutional poem, I, the People. This is Al Filreis, and I hope you'll join us again soon for that or another Poem Talk.